Thank you. This is my fourth time speaking at Nerd Night. And I am very happy to be here. I like coming to Nerd Night, even when I'm not a speaker, because I always learn something. I'm with wonderful people. And yes, I enjoy public speaking. I like getting up here. It's not scary at all. It's easy. And yes, my sanity has been questioned. I am one of a number of local historians for Ypsilanti, Michigan, which has a fantastic history. And incidentally, scenes for the movie Whippet were filmed in Ypsilanti. I just thought I'd mention that. And I have just published my ninth book on local history. Somebody asked me, what's the title? Ypsilanti. He gave me a look and he said, good to see you branching out. Usually I write about murder, mayhem, crime, and other good things. The Ypsilanti community has really been good to me, and this is how I show my gratitude. So I am getting older, aren't I? So now I'm doing my ninth book. It is a picture history of the city from the 60s to the present. An amazing period of history. I'm going to deviate a little bit because I'm going to talk a little bit about a few things that didn't make it into the book. And then I'm going to give you a topic that's not in the book at all, except for one brief reference, the history of Rosie the Riveter. Because everybody thinks they know about Rosie the Riveter, you don't. I'm going to tell you the true story of Rosie the Riveter, and I'm going to get into big trouble for it. But I'm entitled to a little fun. Now, there's more to Ypsilanti than the water tower. Built in 1890, and apparently it didn't occur to them at all what it looked like. Not until about 1916, when the famous landscape architects, the Olmsted brothers, came to Ypsilanti to do a report, they referred to it as having an unfortunate design. And made a suggestion of making some changes. And as I said, Ypsilanti is a wonderful community, and I was limited to only 160 photographs in the picture history by Arcadia. They specialize in picture histories. In fact, Patty Smith, who was here a few months ago, downtown Ann Arbor, is the same publisher. For example, I couldn't find a suitable picture of a man named Peter Fletcher. He was active in the Republican Party. In fact, he was chair of the National Convention in 1980. He never ran for office, but he was appointed to a number of them, including the chair of the Highway Commission. And he referred to himself as Michigan's most notorious highwayman. One day he received a phone call from somebody who asked, what are you going to do for your alma mater, U of M? What are you going to do for them? He had a little talk with the state cartographer, the map maker, and in the section of Northwest Ohio, just south of Michigan, that little strip, the Toledo Strip, they found a couple of crossroads where there was nothing. So they added a couple of names. Go Blue, beat OSU. These maps are now collector's items. Someone wrote a letter to Governor William Milligan complaining about using state resources for a joke. Governor Milliken wrote back saying Peter never accepted compensation for his public service, which made more than made up for the $7 in ink. Incidentally, Peter started a discussion group that continues even now after his death. It meets every Saturday morning, 8:30 a.m. in the Senior Center by Recreation Park. It is open to everyone. You are invited. There's a $3 fee for coffee, donuts, and room rent. It starts at 8:30, ends at 9:30, wide-ranging discussions. It was started originally primarily for Republicans. Democrats and others have been infiltrating. By the way, Peter died a few years ago. And I think at the end of his life, one of his proudest boasts was to point to an opposing politician and say, "We have never agreed on anything, but not once has a harsh word ever passed between us." And I've seen him do that. Mm-hmm. So there's more to the Ypsilanti than a water tower. The name Ypsilanti comes from this man, Demetrios Ypsilantis, hero of the Greek War for Independence against the Ottoman Empire. In short, the city is named for a man who had nothing to do with its founding and was never in North America. How did that come about? Well, I'm going to tell you whether you like it or not. The original community was Woodruff's Grove, about a mile south of downtown Ypsilanti, where Ford Lake is now. The Chicago Road, Michigan Avenue, was surveyed and was the high-tech wonder of its day when it was completed, 1825. A strip of mud from Detroit to Chicago with a hump in the middle. One lane. And so the people in Woodruff's Grove decided they better pack up and go about a mile to the north. This had been the French claims, the trading post founded in the 1790s. The Native Americans had moved west, the trading post had closed, and investors had bought up the claims and started a community. The question came, what do you name it? Would you like to guess what name was not on their list? Well, Palmyra, New York, was where many of them were from. Why not call it Palmyra? Many communities in Michigan are named for communities in New York State. How about Waterville, since the power of the Huron River is so useful to the mills? Delegation went to Detroit to talk to the principal investor, Augustus Beaverwood Woodward. Now, a little clarification here. Woodward Avenue was not named in honor of Augustus Beaverwood Woodward. He named it after himself. He was the Chief Justice of the Territorial Supreme Court of Michigan. And after the fire of 1805, he is the one that drew the radiating main roads from downtown Detroit like the spokes of a wheel. You can blame him. He has been described as a brilliant eccentric. His judicial decisions are said to be near genius. At the same time, he took a bath by sitting in a chair in the rain. I told that story once and somebody asked, "What did the neighbors say?" Thinking quickly, I responded, "Thank God he's taking a bath." He was the one who came up with Ypsilanti. He was fascinated by everything Greek. He was also a personal friend of Thomas Jefferson. Everything Greek fascinated him, and Demetrius Ypsilantis was the big story in all the newspapers. He had led his 300 men into a citadel under siege by 6,000 Turks. Their supplies ran out, and he got his men out without the loss of a single one. He was being called the George Washington of the Greek War for Independence. And Judge Woodward said, let's name it Ypsilanti. And as his word was literally law, they didn't have much choice. And so they named it Ypsilanti. And in 1928, a Greek society presented this bust of Ypsilanti to the city. And January 1st, 1880, the Ypsilanti commercial published a list of 385 misspellings of Ypsilanti. Back in 1999, I co-authored a book on the Depotown area of Ypsilanti with Tom Dodd, and I shared that list with him. And Tom, who took charge of everything he was involved in, he was a high school teacher, decided to include this list to his regret. You can't use spell check on this. And if you want to see the list, it's in the book we produced, Our Heritage Down by the Depot in Ypsilanti. I just happen to have a few copies with me. My favorite, by the way, is Slippery Shanty. Now, in the book, I try to give an explanation of how the city has changed over the years. A little simple thing. This is the view from South Huron Street looking north. The big building on the right is the current City Hall. This was taken before that happened, when it was the Ypsilanti Savings Bank. In the distance, you see St. Luke's Episcopal Church with the tall spire. This was removed in 1970 because of concerns for structural integrity. It turned out it was in better shape than they thought. Now, I'm looking at this with a light directly over it. How does it look to you? Can you see what's going on? Okay. Well, we'll move on soon. Somewhere in the 1960s, they decided to give the old building from the 1880s that modern look. Let's call in the aluminum siding salesman. That's the same building. This was called the cheese grater. It was voted the ugliest city hall in the state of Michigan. I have no idea what they were thinking. About 1970s, City Hall government moved into the building. Finally, in the 1990s, the cheese grater was removed. This is a picture I took for the book. I'm amazed it actually worked, actually in focus. This is the building as it looks today. The glory days of the 1880s are sadly long past, but it looks so much better. Now, one of the sad stories of this area is what's now known as the Michigan murders. In the late 1960s, something like 7 young women were found dead, murdered, mutilated. I'm not going to go into the details. And this house on LaForge Road near Geddes was where some of the early murders are believed to have been committed. Ladies disappeared, probably murdered in the house. Police believe at least one was left there so that the killer, John Norman Collins, would come back and observe the state of decomposition. One of the victims, a teenage girl, is believed to have escaped from him, at least briefly, ran out of the house. Unfortunately, he caught her and dragged her back in and killed her. Police found out that this was where the murders were taking place. Unfortunately, that news was made public before the police were able to put together a plan to try and catch him. And soon after, somebody set the house on fire. Today, there's a automobile research facility on the site. The last victim, Karen Sue Biedemann, spoke her last known words in Wigs by Joan on North Washington Street. And she said she was doing two things she thought she would never do: buy a wig and accept a ride from a stranger on a motorcycle. The women in the shop tried to talk her out of going. A few days later, she was found dead. This time, it was traced to John Norman Collins. He was house-sitting for his uncle and his family. His uncle was a Michigan State police officer who became suspicious of what looked like bloodstains in the basement. Collins is now currently residing in the prison near Marquette. And I think it's safe to say that when he leaves, it will be feet first. Incidentally, little information, this picture and the previous one and the two others concerning this case are from the archives of Eastern Michigan University, from the collection of the student newspaper, the Eastern Echo. And they were sent to me by email, and I'm downloading the pictures, enjoying myself, sitting in Beezy's restaurant on North Washington Street, which today occupies this site. And I am sitting there downloading these pictures in this section here and suddenly realized I'm only a few feet from where Karen Sue Biedemann said her last known words. Did you ever have one of those days where you were walking around with the urge to keep looking over your shoulder? And you know how I felt for the rest of the week. Also, I know the man who owns the house where the murder was committed. And I didn't know I was going on so long. I got a ways to go yet. And he told me that he's never had a problem. The house has been extensively remodeled. Nothing strange has happened except one night. He's in the basement entertainment room. The dog suddenly jumps up, hair's back on its back of its head. It's barking at a spot, growling. Something was bothering it. Nothing to be seen. That was the spot where it's believed the murder was committed, and it was the anniversary of the murder. I'll try and get past these through. Okay. One of the major stories that's taking place now is the Yankee Air Museum in the site of what was the Willow Run bomber plant during World War II. So, of course, when working on the book, I had to contact the Yankee Air Museum and ask if they had some pictures. I wanted a picture of the old museum in the old hangar where they started out. And I received this picture. I was very pleased with it. I sent it in to the publisher and they said, we can't use it. There's a problem with it. I tried this, I tried that, I tried everything else. Nothing worked. This picture cannot be used for the book. So I had to ask for more pictures of the hangar. And the Yankee Air Museum Knight politely sent me, well actually they sent me this one, which I liked. That's the B-17 bomber that they restored. It is one of the finest restoration jobs of a B-17 ever done. There's less than 20 that can fly today. This is a nice one. Here's another one with the B-17. That's a nice one. But I chose to go with the first one. I sent it in. The nice people at Arcadia said, this is nice, this works, thank you. So when you look in the book, and I have copies, of course I do, you will see for the picture of the old museum, this one. Now many of you, of course, know that they no longer use the hangar, and you know why. The B-52 bomber in front, by the way, was not damaged in the fire. They lost a lot of their collection. The B-17 was saved, as well as some other planes. I remember that, this big column of smoke visible from downtown Ypsilanti, and we could smell that fire. Well, they have been, well, now that the bomber plant is being demolished, there was the move to put the Yankee Air Museum in part of the old building, but they had to buy it. It was a big fundraiser. And part of the effort, they invoked the image of Rosie the Riveter. And as part of that, they had 776 women show up to set a Guinness Book of World Record for the biggest, largest number of women dressed as Rosie the Riveter. They set the record. This helped to the fundraising, and it was dedicated, I think, yesterday, the new museum. They've got a lot of work to do. They have a lot of work to do, but it's going to be a big boon for this area when it's done. By the way, they do have a museum going. It's worth visiting. Maybe none of them looked like Rosie the Riveter because they were based on this image. And she's not Rosie the Riveter. There is nothing in the picture that calls her Rosie. There is nothing in the picture that says she did riveting. So who is she? She is Geraldine Huff Doyle. Born in Inkster, graduated from high school in Ann Arbor. At the age of 17, she went to work at a steel press machine where this picture was taken. Graphic artist J. Milton Miller saw it and used this for a series of pictures to encourage better relations between workers and management in the Westinghouse plants. It was visible in employee-only areas of Westinghouse plants, not to the general public. It was put up on bulletin boards for 2 weeks and then taken down and forgotten until the 1980s when it reemerged as a feminist icon and somehow became identified as Rosie the Riveter. Geraldine Huff Doyle, by the way, never saw this poster until 1984. She didn't know a thing about it. This is one of the posters that J. Martin Miller did to encourage good relations, not women leaving the home and starting careers in the factories. By the way, at its peak production period, the Willow Run bomber plant was turning out a bomber an hour. 60% of the workforce was women. All right, ladies, I'll admit it. We couldn't have won the war without you. Another in the series. Just after the poster was taken down, the song Rosie the Riveter was released. Probably inspired by a woman named Rosalind from a prominent family. She had taken a job as a riveter in New Jersey, I think. And the first verse of the song goes something like, while other girls are sipping martinis and eating caviar in their favorite cocktail bar, there's a girl who's putting them to shame. Rosie is her name. And it goes on, she's making history, working for victory. And it concludes with something like, Senator Smith, who's in the know, proclaimed on the radio, Moscow will cheer about, Berlin will hear about, Rosie the Riveter. And then came out the Norman Rockwell cover for the Saturday Evening Post. The model for this picture was a 19-year-old young lady who was a telephone operator near where Rockwell lived. He recruited her and later apologized for giving her that muscular look. He said that she was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen. I don't know what his wife thought of that. But she is clearly Rosie. Rosie is on her lunchbox, and she is a riveter. So here we have the image of Rosie the Riveter. And then, Walter Pidgeon, Hollywood actor, went to the Willow Run bomber plant to make a film for War Bonds. And there they met Rose Will Monroe, a tomboy from Kentucky, mother of two. She had gone there originally because she wanted to learn how to fly. She was hoping to get a job flying the finished B-24 bombers to their destinations. But because she had two children, they would not permit that. So they made her a riveter. And so there's the film crew talking with a woman named Rose working as a riveter at the bomber plant. This is too good to pass up. She agreed to make the film. Over in the Ypsilanti Historical Archives, we have been searching for that film. One of my colleagues there, fellow volunteer George Reidenauer, his nickname is Cadaver Dog. He has been searching for it on behalf of the Yankee Air Museum. We can't find it. It appears to be lost, the film. So I would say Rose Will Monroe is Rosie the Riveter. And so there's a lot more to Ypsilanti than the water tower. We're a community of friendly people with a few grouches mixed in. This, by the way, is the Spanish-American War Memorial. Looking toward the Demetrius Ypsilantis bust and the water tower and the future.